netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Dr. Michael Johnson, who runs the Moving Pictures Group at Pixar. Before we get to that, I wanted to mention that we'll be in full force for SIGGRAPH. Mike Seymour and John Montgomery are heading in from Chicago and Sydney to do complete coverage of the show. We'll try to do some FX Guide TV episodes, podcasts, and also pick up content for FX PhD as well. It's a really SIGGRAPH is a great show. It's in Los Angeles, so no doubt I'll be working because, as any of us who work in LA know, that's what normally happens during SIGGRAPH when it's in LA. But hope to see many of you down there whenever we can. Like I said, we'll be there in full force and hopefully bring you a good coverage of the show like we've done in the past few years. Wanted to also mention that there's a survey at fxguide.com. We're just trying to get some demographic information. So if you go head over to fxguide.com/survey for FX Guide readers only, one entry per person. And just for doing a simple survey, you could win a 16 gig Wi-Fi iPad. So if you're looking at this after July 23rd, I'm sorry about that. But for those of you who did take the time, thanks a lot. We also have a new term starting over at FX PhD. I want to talk a little bit about that after the podcast, but I want to jump in right away to the podcast now with Michael Johnson from the Moving Pictures Group at Pixar. It's a nice technical chat, and Mike also takes advantage of the opportunity to talk to Michael about some good history stuff. Michael was involved with the MIT Media Lab and Thinking Machines, which both were involved in a lot of the things we take for granted now. And if you're a fan, Mike Seymour and I are both big fans of the book Being Digital back in the day by Nicholas Negroponte. And Mike talks to Michael about some of that time there. And, you know, things like the RAID discs that we take for granted and parallel processing that the Thinking Machines was doing, you know, way before anybody else was. So anyway, interesting chat. And also the stuff about Pixar, the Moving Pictures Group. So much of what we see in visual effects now is, you know, groups being put together for a film and workflows being developed for a film and really not a lot of attention being paid to the infrastructure and asset management and creative tools being designed that are improved constantly and repeatedly. And big shops, I'm sure, are doing this. But Pixar is kind of the perfect environment for this type of development. And that's what Michael is going to talk about how they do that and how they develop these tools and have that big picture view of understanding that they're going to be making movies for a long time and developing these assets and tools to improve the filmmaking are so important. And it's really rarefied air that they live in Pixar, and they're well aware of that. But it's just an interesting lesson, I think. If you look at the success of Pixar, it's hard not to look at things like this and think that people should be emulating the better parts of it that make it successful. And this certainly sounds like one of those areas. So let's jump in now to this conversation with Mike Seymour with Michael Johnson.
I've been really looking forward to talking to you about the work that your group does. But if somebody listening isn't aware of what the group does, maybe you could outline what your team there at Pixar actually does.
Sure. So I've been at Pixar about 17 years now, and I started, we used to have an interactive group, and Ed Catmull was on my PhD committee at the Media Lab at MIT. And so originally I worked on what you would kind of think of more the production things, the animation system, a little bit on the rendering stuff, a little bit on modeling and various other tools for the production pipeline. And about 9 years ago or so, I started to get a little frustrated is probably too strong a word, but began to get really interested in kind of earlier in the pipeline. And we didn't really have much in the way of technology there up in the, we cut on Avids and we had sort of a workflow for getting things in and out of it, but it was pretty ad hoc. And then in terms of tracking, say, dialogue and, you know, script pages was pretty rudimentary, and in story it was all paper, and in art it was all sort of traditional media. So we started about about 8 or 9 years ago, I guess. And the first sort of big thing that we did that was somewhat splashy was we wrote a sketching tool for Brad Bird, which actually we used on Nemo as well. So this is in sort of a 2001 time frame, I think. And it was a pretty simple idea. It was just it was basically a telestrator. So anything that would go to a projection system in the studio, there would be a Cintiq there running this little kiosk app that would let them draw over it. But the thing that made it be a hit was it worked very naturally and fluidly. It was a vector-based drawing system with a raster erase. If you turned the pen over and erased, it would erase like you would expect. But the nice thing was that it was was essentially a kiosk app. It was sort of always there. It was always on. And the drawings were immediately being served up on a website internally there, so you could get to both the drawing and then the comp of it over whatever it was you were looking at. And then over the years, we upgraded that, and so now there's about 20 of them installed, I guess, in the studio, and it's HD now instead of standard F like it was when we started. But that was the first thing. And then from there, we started doing things in some interesting combination of essentially pre-production work. So the story department, the editorial department. Now we do editorial story art. Now we're also doing production management stuff. And another theme through this has been review things. So anything we're trying to kind of what the director sees is sort of a lot of times they're looking at our stuff or they're looking at it through some filter that we gave them. And so we're trying
In the traditional sense, people in all areas of production have done storyboards and then taken them into Avid and put them together. Though mm-hmm. obviously on a storyboard at the level that you guys have taken it to, it's much akin, I think you've said in articles, to almost like a whole rough version of the film. And I guess in that respect, you touch on audio there, but in fact there's an enormous amount of audio editing that goes into a Pixar film, isn't there? So there's, even on something as simple as just the audio bed that you might be looking at the storyboard pictures over, there's quite a lot of complexity in sort of every aspect of putting that rough version of the film together.
Oh, absolutely. You've got temp effects, you've got temp music, you've got scratch vocals. I mean, there's 24 tracks of audio on that, and they're using pretty much all of them. It's pretty stunning how much effort the editorial folks put into the audio. The other part of it is that they do all the recordings of both the scratch talent and the actual production talent, and that can be a couple of hundred hours of recording, and all of those they go into, the assistant editors will, in the Avid, go in and cut that up and mark it up and do all sorts of things on it. And then we actually loop that back out and have a tool that we actually first wrote for Toy Story 3 that will sort of make all that stuff externally searchable and auditionable outside the Avid, which is a kind of a big deal around here.
Yeah, and I guess the other interesting thing is, if that's the complexity that's happening on audio, let's say a film like The Incredibles, which I love to death, was obviously very strong in its dialogue, you then get mm-hmm. films like WALL-E, where there's enormous stretches of the film with no dialogue, and so those boards have to communicate stuff where dialogue would obviously normally be able to carry forward the story. You're having to carry the story without the benefit of the dialogue.
Well, there's a lot of dialogue in WALL-E. It's just not in English. No, I'm totally serious. I mean, we built a whole pipeline of stuff because originally the thought was, because Andrew has a script that he wrote, it's just a question then of, they were originally going to sort of process all that stuff through it, but then he and Ben essentially came up with their own way of doing that. But, it, you know, Ben's the voice of WALL-E through that first whole 30 minutes, and then so there is actually a fair amount of dialogue going on in there. It's just not English.
Maybe I should have used the example of Up, but again, in Up, there's a strong section of film that's incredibly emotionally and effectively communicating story without mm-hmm. being driven by dialogue, I guess, is the point. So those
right.
tools.
But a lot of that is actually being driven by music.
Right.
So there's a great back and forth going on there. But yeah, I mean, I certainly understand what you're saying, and it is true. Some things are much chattier than others, but there is, you know, there's both the sound effects work, there's the, as well as the dialogue stuff, as well as the music, and sometimes those are the same people and sometimes they're not. But in terms of sort of constructing that stuff, I mean, back to your original point, we do make the movie many, many times before it's what you would think of as, you know, the one that you see in the theater. I mean, on Up, I believe we had 13 storyboard screenings of that movie along the way, which is an enormous amount of work to sort of bring those things together for a screening.
Which brings to that point that you got onto, that you've done a lot more work in production management, because it's an area that's not very sexy, but absolutely it's almost the key to the IP of a facility these days, to be able to run a production, especially in the case of Pixar, where you're running concurrently films that are coming out overlapping, as it were. You're not like finishing one film before the next one started.
Right. I mean, it's a very hard problem, and we don't pretend to know exactly what we're doing. We do know what we've done in the past and what worked and what didn't. And you know, in every movie, you try and learn from it. But it's hard because on the R&D side, we tend to be the constant between these productions, because a lot of times people will leapfrog productions, mm-hmm. because they'll have worked on this movie, you know, they'll have worked on movie A, and then movie B is going on, and they wrap from movie A and they move on to movie C.
Right.
And they don't learn any of the thing, you know, and so a lot of times we'll have these people that, especially the long-lived departments like editorial or art or story, where they might be on a show for several years, they'll kind of come out of, you know, we have to sort of do a big dog and pony show to show them how the world has changed since that show locked on the technology they had done, because it might be 4 years, you know, because you'll be on a movie and you'll lock on the technology at some point, and you're not going to change it out until your movie gets done. But in the meantime, we've been evolving it, and then we've also been coming up with new stuff, and that's sort of a challenge to get people to pay attention to the new stuff that you've done and not just rely on their muscle memory of the old procedures or the old technologies that they had. And you have to really come up with things that, you know, my line is always, you need to make people visibly better at their job for them to want to adopt this new process or technology that you've built, because otherwise there's no upside to them. They have really great, you know, we have really smart people at Pixar, and they're, you know, very, have really solid muscle memory about the processes that they do, and they're just trying to do their creative job, and there's a lot of non-creative tool stuff that you have to use to do that. And so if you're kind of mucking with their map of the creative space that they're operating in, it's not a helpful thing. It's got to actually make them better.
But it is in that period that you're talking about that the group would identify the technical issues that the studio as a whole and its additional RenderMan development team would have to deal with, because presumably at that early stages, it's the bit where somebody says, this guy has fur, we need to work on that, or this one has massive garbage that we need to solve for, like, you know, rendering issues to do with complexity or whatever. So a lot of that stuff is coming out during that period. That can you talk about that process of, like, identifying technology that is needed to be developed to achieve the task?
Well, I think there's multiple things that are kind of at odds with each other, which is that you don't want the story people to be technology driven in terms of, is this a hard problem to solve, but you also want the technical leadership on the film to be aware of what might be coming, and it's a real complicated process, because one of the big things that we try and do on the tool side of things is, the way I always talk about it is try and remove tension from the room, because a lot of times what can happen is a movie a long time ago, I was in a meeting and the editorial folks and the story folks were getting rather heated with each other, and I realized that what was going on was the fact that they were each being essentially made to look bad in front of the director. For technology reasons, for basically this department couldn't, you know, story couldn't get their stuff quickly enough to editorial, so editorial was looking bad because it wasn't able to walk, you know, from the story room right into the editorial room and start seeing it cut. And the same thing on the other side is, once it was in editorial and the director was calling out fixes, story couldn't turn those around fast enough because it wasn't easy for editorial to communicate what they needed to story for them to start working on it. And that's the kind of stuff that we can help with. And so if you can make those, and the thing that we do really well, and I think it's the thing that's a testament to the way that Pixar both is constructed and continues to be run, is that you have people who, I mean, I've worked on every single one of our movies, and so, you know, you have a whole bunch of people here who've worked on these a lot, and so even if we weren't that bright to begin with, we're now pretty experienced, at least. What that means is that you can make these sort of lovely pipelines that can can allow people to communicate with each other in a way where they feel safe and they feel like they're being understood. And if you can set that up, then your story people are probably more willing to show their technical leads where they're at, even if they're in an early stage, so that their technical people can say, oh, really? So there's going to be a lot of garbage. How likely is that to change? I don't know. It might change. Okay, well, we should probably start looking into garbage or whatever it is. And so I think that's one of the great things about being a studio is that you can build up these relationships between people over time, and they trust each other. And that's the way things get done, is when people are willing to, I don't know, whatever the right term is, but sort of, you know, open the kimono or whatever kind of thing, of just basically being able to share across departmental boundaries to where they may be headed and know that they're not going to be held entirely accountable for that if they do change their mind and they decide they're not going to go with garbage, they're going to go with, you know, diseased plants or rusted things or something like that. And that's really hard to do.
And there have been a whole bunch of really good, oh my God, kind of technological challenges. I mean, for example, everything from, I don't know, brick maps. Well, you go back to like the ray tracing for the cars, the fur in Monsters, there's a whole lot of things. Was there anything that came up over Toy Story 3, either in terms of managing assets or in fact accessing old assets that was an oh my gosh moment on Toy Story 3?
The oh my gosh thing, that's a hard one. I do think that probably the biggest struggle on Toy Story 3 was everybody from an exterior perspective thought it would be easy, in the sense that, oh, well, you guys have done a bunch of these now, and you can just reuse all that stuff, right? And but Toy Story 3, I think by a lot, has more characters than we've ever had in a movie, and you have all these essentially aesthetic constraints on the look of the film, because you have two other. And not only the look in terms of rendering and in terms of shading, but in terms of animation, everybody knows how Woody runs, and, you know, he's a rag doll, and everybody knows how Buzz operates, and that he has very particular kind of pivot points and stuff. And you've got people here who have animated a lot, and they can make extraordinarily fluid animations. And so, you know, Toy Story brings this kind of aesthetic box around it, which normally, like if you have a world like Wall-E or Ratatouille, there's a box around it, but we made the box, right? And so we can decide, you know, how do rats, are they on four legs? Are they on two legs? Are they on two legs when they're acting in the human world? Are they on four legs when they're this? Is it because he wants to keep his hands clean? Is it because he thinks he's a human? Why is he on two legs? You know, it's a whole new world, and you can design those rules versus Toy Story, where not only, you know, are the rules already set, but, you know, there's a lot more people think they know the rules of the looks and things like that. So I think a lot of it was just executing against those expectations, because it was a very big movie to make, and I know it was hard. I think it was slightly more straightforward than some of our other movies have been, but because of the scale of it, it really needed to be more straightforward, because there were so many characters going on, and the expectations were very high.
Yeah, the expectations obviously were high. I think what was amusing me, I heard about how fast it was doing the re-renders on Toy Story 1 for the stereoscopic release. And I can imagine that would have fed this idea that you wouldn't have had technological challenges. Though when one's seen Toy Story 3 and sees especially that end sequence with the kind of level of detail and the complexity of particle systems and stuff, you could imagine that wasn't the case. But that does bring up an important point about reuse, because apart from the obvious in-gags of, say, the Pizza Planet truck being reused, there must be an enormous need to manage the assets and the texture so as to allow for reuse, just on a purely practical level, to not reinvent every tree.
I think the thing that people don't realize, especially technical, or people who come at it from a more technical perspective, is, and this is something I think technical people wouldn't think about, but once you point it out, they will immediately understand it, which is a lot of times, and I'm not that involved with this part of it, so I'm not saying that this is exactly the case, but I think it is the case that in a lot of the technical cases, you know, you don't reuse a lot of that stuff. What you do reuse is the design. You do, because you go, it's the case of sort of painting one corner of your kitchen, right? As soon as you paint that one corner, then you suddenly see how the rest of it looks a little off,
right.
You know, a little scuffed up. And I certainly remember that. I mean, I was a TD on Toy Story 2, and I certainly remember that in the case of when Jessie was made, and she looked so much better than Woody did, and the way the denim was done on her, and the way that her checkered, you know, kerchief was, and all that stuff. It was so much crisper and more detailed, and very much in the same world as Woody, but it made him look very not even just shabby, but it made him sort of look less well-made than he had looked before you saw the new Jessie. And so I don't know for a fact that was the case in the Toy Story 3 stuff, but I bet in a lot of cases the TDs would rebuild certain geometries because they could, because this is going to be subdivs now instead of whatever it was before or whatever. But I think a lot of that is... So again, my point in terms of that is the fact that one of the things that's most important is to actually share the design assets, which that's one thing we did for Toy Story 3 was we built a new asset management system for the art department, and that was a web app. It was a system we wrote called Focus that was written specifically for Toy Story 3. It's been very successful, and the rest of the studio now uses it. But and that came at a very particular time, a point in time of technology of where basically a few things happened that were really helpful, which is one, the web app stuff began to not be bogus. It actually began to be something where you actually could build an enterprise app that had the performance that you wanted on it. Number two, you had web browsers that had color management built into them, which was obviously an important thing in the art department workflow. And number three, we were building out and using certain back-end systems on the production side, namely Perforce and Oracle, and we had this thumbnailing system that we had built ourselves, and that we had sort of the pieces to sort of serve this stuff up on the server side. And the final thing was, this was one of the few tools, mostly my group tends to do kind of command line apps that run on Unix, which is to say Linux or Mac OS X, or we write what we refer to as artist-facing apps, which are Cocoa apps that run on the Mac, and those are things for art people in the art department, people in the story department, people in the editorial department, production management people. Those are all people who use Macs. Most of the rest of the studio would use Linux boxes. So this was an interesting case of where, for the art department, we needed to both service the three sets of people, production management people, you know, coordinators and managers, and production designers and art directors, and artists, the artists actually working in the art department, as well as technical artists, the TDs who would wanting to be checking in textures or browsing through texture libraries or browsing through sketches and model packets of characters and stuff like that. And so the fact that we could do color management on Linux and the Mac in the web browser, and the fact that we now suddenly needed to service both technical people, for want of a better term, on the TD side, who would have Linux boxes on their desk and probably not have a Mac, and also artists who would just have a Mac, who would be either an artist or a production management person. So that was a sort of a particular confluence of events. In the meantime, we've now written a lot more production web apps, and that's something we're pretty high on these days. We're pretty happy with that.
The color management stuff is to do with validating and calibrating and maintaining a consistent color space. Presumably you're not doing actual 3D LUT profiling of final output stuff. This is more just to get consistency between the areas.
Yeah. Yes, consistency. It's color managed. It's not, I mean, they may be looking at it on an LCD that we haven't tweaked or something like that, but at least it's managed through the pipeline. So if they do go and look at it on a machine in a right lighting that's all been set up, we can guarantee that we're doing the best we can.
How many people are in your moving pictures group?
It's just 12 people.
Right. I've got a confession to make. I would talk to you all day about Pixar, but I've got a confession to make. I'm a huge fan of the old MIT Media Lab, and before that, I believe you were at Thinking Machines.
Yep.
And I just can't
actually
not,
at the same time. I was there for about 4 years.
Oh, really? I just can't not talk to you and mention those times, because that was the sort of golden age of the MIT Media Lab. It was the center of the digital universe. Can you just quickly just give me some idea what it was like to be back then? Because that was like defining the digital age we now live in. It was, you know, the beginning of everything.
Well, I remember when I was almost almost done, and it was in the kind of early mid 90s, and I was Nicholas Negroponte, who's the head of the lab, was giving a talk to new students, and Margaret Minsky and I and somebody else were sitting in the back of the room there, and Nicholas, as Nicholas is wont to do, was being very provocative, and he said something to the people, like, he's like, "Now you people, now why did you come here? Why did you enroll in this? Do you think this is going to make you, you know, more money? Do you think this is going to do this? You see those people in the back?" And we're all like, "Oh no." He goes, "They came here when there was no good reason to be here. They came here because no one else would have them. No one else understood." You know, it was just this funny thing. And Steve Benton, sort of followed that up with, he said, If it's straightforward for you to be employed after you leave here, we have failed in our educational mission to you," which I always appreciate. Because, I mean, the idea was that they wanted you to go off and start your own damn company, not...
Yeah, no, I mean, look, being
digital...
Not slot
into someplace comfortably.
Being digital was the Bible book, and Nicholas's back page Wired column was the sort of, you know, monthly sermon from the mount, and not only that, but Thinking Machines was such an extraordinary company, and people like Carl Sims, of course, we know were back there then, but mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of people yeah. that have come.
Carl
from
was
that.
His office was next to mine,
and they're just that yeah. that must have been an amazing time, because again, that was, I mean, the we think of Brenda Farms today, and there's obviously inherent parallelism that we take for granted. But back then, that idea of massive parallelism was just so revolutionary.
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually I left Thinking Machines in '93, and went to Pixar. So yeah, it's no, I mean, Thinking Machines was a very fun place. It was a real moment in time. I mean, that's the funny thing, is it's like the Media Lab has actually had multiple golden ages, if you will. I think the thing that the sort of physical media stuff that they've been doing for the last couple of years, stuff with Neil Gershenfeld and his group, is pretty awesome, and a lot of the sort of physical making thing is really interesting. But they've kind of, the Media Lab is sort of up, and I mean, I actually just got my invitation for the 25th anniversary, which will be in October, and I remember being there at the 5th anniversary. So nothing like that to make you feel old. But
you were there at the height of the, you know, atoms versus bits and the whole thing, right? Like that was, I mean, that was...
As I was leaving, that was sort of, yeah. I mean, I was there 87 to 95.
But you guys were defining so much what sort of then became popular culture or technical culture.
Well, I wouldn't say we were defining it. I'd say we were one of the players. I mean, there was a lot of awesome stuff going on in lots of places. But no, it was definitely a very special time, and there were lots of very... I mean,
But I cut you off. I think you're about to talk about Thinking Machines. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were about to say something.
Yeah, no, just Thinking Machines was an interesting one, because Thinking Machines, as opposed to the Media Lab, which I think has this sort of... waxing and waning of its sort of relevance to popular media culture. I think Thinking Machines was definitely, it was, you know, I was at NCSA before that, and it was before the whole web stuff. But there are definitely these places that you're at where you're there for some few years, and you just feel, you look back on that, and you're like, well, that was a really good time. And Thinking Machines was like that. I mean, I was there, I don't know, 88 to 90. Two, I guess, and I was there for 4 years, and you know, and there were lots of fun. I mean, Brewster Kahle spun off to start the what turned into Alexa, which they then sold to Amazon. There was all the Dow Jones stuff, and yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time, because a lot of the stuff that we worked on were really more ideas than actual physical things, because the computational speed of those things has got eclipsed so fast. It was kind of amazing. But, you know, RAID and all that sort of stuff came out of the work that was going on there, because we had the Data Vault, which was this big redundant array system, and all the sort of little RAID arrays that you can sort of put on your desktop now for drives and stuff like that. I mean, we used to make these really big, you know, I forget now how many they were, if they were 32-way or 64-way. But, you know, and it was to get a couple of gigabytes of disk storage that you could do it at speeds like that. So it's a little embarrassing to talk about that stuff now, because you're sort of like, wow, my iPad is faster than some of these things with its solid state drive or something. You know, I should look that up and figure out how many you know, a 64 gig iPad may actually be faster and larger than the data vault that we sold back then.
And the thing is, you went to Pixar in 93. Now, Toy Story is 95. Uh-huh. So Pixar at this time, and I mentioned this because of the advent of Sid Graff coming up obviously in a couple of weeks. So at that time, Pixar was the darling of the Sid Graff community because of the short films from Luxo Jr., but it hadn't released Toy Story. So it's hard to remember a time when Pixar was a question of whether it was going to work or not. And I guess in 93, even though you were there as an intern, you must have been aware that it was cutting edge, but by no means a guarantee of success.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's one of these things of where I remember specifically having having dinner with Carl Rosendahl, who started PDI, and saying to Carl, you know, hey, you know, would you, you know, like I'm, you know, I'm doing the PhD now. I finished my master's, and I said, you know, like, would you hire me, Carl? You know, when I finished up, I mean, like, would there, you know, is there like, where are the places that I could work? And he's like, well, Michael, I'd hire you, but it would be in spite of you having a PhD. and the thing about, which I thought was a very honest answer, but the thing was, is Pixar was one of the only places, still probably is one of the only places that your sort of academic credibility actually got you street credibility inside the studio. I mean, you still had to prove yourself that you knew how to work on this stuff. But for those of us who actually did do a more academic route through computer graphics, it continues to be a pretty rare place where that's not held against you that you're that you went to school for a long time. And so,
to that end, it's been very supportive of Sid Graff at an academic level, not as a marketing exercise, not as a
absolutely,
you know, but as an honest contributor to the field of understanding computer graphics since almost day one. Pixar's been there publishing.
And that's Ed Catmull. I mean, that's you know, and then down through Tony DeRose, who's head of research, and Evan Ospy, and Bill Reeves, and Rob Cook, and all these people who have sort of leadership roles in this stuff, that's been there from the very beginning. And I think it's served us very well. And, you know, I think we are a sort of an honest contributor to that stuff. And I think that's an important thing.
I presume you're going to Sid Graff this year in L.A.?
I am probably not this year. I kind of go back and forth. I mean, that's a part of the problem for my thing is that, you know, Sid Graff is really about this stuff that I did for the first 15 or 20 years of my career, and it's not really what I've been doing the last 10 years.
Right.
It's less and less about the sort of production pipeline. Part of the problem is that, it's just our stuff is, as a guy I went to grad school with, Tinsley Gallien, said one time in grad school, he said, you know, Michael, we must love computer graphics because we get to do so little of it. You know, so much of what we do is plumbing and sort of debugging processes and stuff like that, and it's not really about making a picture.
But it is tremendously interesting how much the filmmaker side of your, which, you know, obviously doesn't appear on your CV, but must come through in your day-to-day work. Do you feel like a filmmaker today, or do you feel like an R&D engineer?
No, I mean, I feel like a filmmaker. I mean, it's one of these things of where, because you come to understand that that your contribution to being a filmmaker is being an R&D engineer and designer, and that you know, the guys who developed the Panavision lens, you know for anamorphic stuff, they're as much a filmmaker as, you know, anybody else in that thing. It's filmmaking is fundamentally collaborative. No one makes a film by themselves, and so you need to understand sort of where can you. I mean, there's two different parts, right? Hopefully they line up. Which is one of them, which is what are you good at? What can you contribute to the making of this film? And number two, what's the part that actually pushes your buttons and gets you excited, and you actually want to work on that? Luckily for me, those things actually line up, which is that I like working with both. I mean, the way I think of it is I like working with the sort of the people with the political clout, the producers, the production designers, the directors, as well as the sort of feet on the ground, the PAs and the coordinators, the artists who are actually sort of using your tools directly. And you need the people with the political clout because they're paying the bills. They need to understand what they're paying for and why you guys are spending time trying to solve this problem versus this other problem. But if you're not working, if you're not making the artists or the production management people look good and be better at their job, then you're not actually helping. But those are the two parts.
Just in finishing up, looking forward, like I think there must be a really tremendously rewarding aspect to, there is no expectation of Pixar stopping. In other words, there's no sort of like, if this film works, we're good, otherwise we're dead. So it must be possible at looking forward to actually put up on the whiteboard and say, well, you know what, if we spent time developing this, it's going to help us not next week, not next month, but next year or the year after, because you do have this sense of a continuum. You do have a sense of a pipeline moving forward. It must be kind of rewarding to have the ability, in so rare in the industry, to have some really good forward planning.
Yeah, no, I mean, we do that all the time. We have the advantage that, and again, this is the thing of where if you're in communication with the directors and the production designers and the producers about what's coming down the pike, of what's being pitched and what they're talking about, then you can have some awareness of where you can be like, oh, well, that's so-and-so. Well, you know, I bet if we gave them something like this, that would help them. And then you can talk to them over lunch about it. And, you know, a lot of times, frankly, you know, 3 out of 4 of my ideas are crap, or they're not what I thought they were when I sort of pitched them to the person, be like, well, what if we gave you this tool that did this? Or what if, you know, you didn't need to do that thing, you could do it this way. You know, a lot of times you're like, nah, you know, I really like to do it this way because of this, that, and the other. But, you know, every once in a while you'll hit one where they'll be like, oh, that would be really awesome. And then it gets you excited. You can get the team back in on that. And we're very lucky because in our group we get to basically do both day-to-day support, which is really important because it keeps the relationship strong with you in production, as well as doing kind of month-to-month, we're going to roll out this thing in 3 months, as well as, well, here's where we're shooting for 3 to 4 years from now, but keeping ourselves honest on that. We've been very lucky about being able to do that. And, it's a pretty unique place for that. I'm not quite sure where else you could get away with that. it's also being entirely transparent with what you're doing, that you're doing all 3 of those things and you're not kind of running the skunk works on the side and then going, ta-da! You can actually, you know, your boss is actually entirely aware of that some of this stuff that you're doing is going to pay off, you know, 3 years from now as soon as we get all this stuff lined up. And that's a pretty rare thing. And as Andrew Stanton was at a talk one time, he was giving a Sundance with a bunch of other writers, and he was explaining our process to some people, and one of the other writers leans into the microphone and says, "Where do you live, Fairyland?" which I thought was very good. And so, we are aware that we live in Fairyland.
Yeah, well, look, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us and to go in such technical detail. It is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, thanks, guys. You know, I have to add that I was recently watching a documentary, an older documentary on Apple computing and the Macintosh. And they were talking about how, you know, the competitors all have access to the same technology and the same tools and the same inventiveness, if you will, but that Apple tends to do things differently and that the competitors just don't even know what to steal. And I think that Pixar is a good example of that. I mean, here's a company that just has had success after success, and people try to emulate the wrong things from Pixar and don't realize that. I'd say the same thing about ILM in some ways. You know, something about having a team of people that's consistent and stays put and knows how to work together and is not worried about where the next film is while they're still on the film that they're working on. It's interesting times in our business, and it's interesting to see such phenomenal success coming from a company like Pixar, and people should be paying attention to what they're doing and in a much broader way than just, they seem to be really good at this. Anyway, that's enough on that. I just wanted to throw that in there because it really struck me listening to this interview with Michael. So I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that the new term just started at FX PhD, and I thought I'd take a second to just tell you some of the classes that I'll be checking out. Every term I like to look at the class list and see what applies to me and where I think I could learn some development from participating. So I wanted to mention, first of all, there's going to be a new digital SLR cinematography course. If you saw the one that Stu Mashwitz helped us with in Tokyo, I think you'll be impressed. I mean, that the target has obviously been moving quite a bit. And there's been a lot of developments since that class was finished. So this is going to be Mike and John with Captain Tyler Ginter of the 55th Combat Camera Company. And they're going to be shooting this class at Yellowstone National Park, more of a nature focus. Hopefully they'll catch a complete double rainbow. This class should be very interesting. There's been a lot of gear arriving here in the Los Angeles FX Guide headquarters for the shoot. And I know that Tyler's arranged some deals with some manufacturers, and it's going to be an interesting look at a lot of the technology and equipment and just the art of shooting this type of work and using these cameras. So check that out. There's a great course called Tools of the DOP, which, you know, you may think, I'm not a DOP, I don't care. But if you have to have interactions with directors of photography, it's a great way to just up your skill set and up your knowledge base and understand some of the problems that they have on set and some of the tools that they have at their disposal. Similarly, you may not use Final Cut Pro, but the Red Giant class for Final Cut Pro, looking at things like Magic Bullet suite of products and Trap Code and things like that. I mean, I know from my standpoint in the flame, I'm always trying to keep my eye on what can be done better in other tools and what tools are available to After Effects and Final Cut. And certainly as a finishing end in Smoke and Flame, you know, we see things coming from Final Cut now, and you go, whoa, that was tracked in there, and that was, you know, okay, wait, that was flipped, and that was, you know, the color correction's been tweaked, and, you know, it's just interesting to know the tools. So even if you're not actively going to use these tools, which I would recommend if you have Final Cut, I think these tools are all very, very, very excellent. I've been using Magic Bullet for a while now, and I love it, for example. Anyway, check out that class. Background Fundamentals, Mike Seymour is going to take more of a magazine approach to this terms. Background Fundamentals class, one of my favorite classes of all times, is the Background Fundamentals every term. And he's going to also focus on, you know, job acquisition skills, resumes and things like that, which we've done in the past, which has always been very popular, and he's going to update that information. There's also a new RealFlow course, a Vue course, Premiere Pro CS5, a Nuke Stereo Masterclass. So anyway, check it out over at fxphd.com. The term just started. It's very affordable, I don't think you'll be disappointed if you check it out. So, and don't forget that survey I mentioned at the top, fxguide.com/survey. If you want to help us out with that. So thanks very much for listening. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.